And here is the weekly peeker for the week of January 25th. 101 years ago this week, Woodrow Wilson signed the bill establishing Rocky Mountain National Park. Rocky Mountain National Park is located in the northern Rocky Mountains of Colorado. The park straddles the Continental Divide, and a third of the park is located above 11,000 feet. Every year, 3,000 visitors travel to Rocky Mountain National Park to take advantage of the 355 miles of hiking trails, the 150 lakes, and numerous streams that course through the mountainous terrain. Joining the visitors in the park are all manner of animals, including elk, bighorn sheep, mule deer, and 56 other species of mammals. Birdwatchers can also find a great variety of birds with Dr. Seuss-approved names like water ouzels and Clark nutcrackers. The Ute and Arapaho Indian tribes were early inhabitants of the area that would eventually be included in the boundaries of the park. One of the early European expeditions to the area was led by Stephen H. Long, who never actually set foot in what would be Rocky Mountain National Park, but nevertheless had the tallest peak in the park named after him. Long's Peak is the only 14er in the park, with a height of 14,259 feet. Among the early European settlers was the 4th Earl of Dunraven. This Anglo-Irish gentleman had visited the area many times and in 1874 used the Homestead Act to lay claim on several thousand acres around Estes Park for a private game reserve. Starting in 1876, new settlers came to the area and began establishing farms on the Earl's vast claims. In what would probably seem ironic to the Native Americans that had previously lived in the area, the Earl took exception to the new interlopers. Despite his best efforts to enforce his dubious claims, the Earl eventually left the Rocky Mountains, but did not give up his claim until 1907. Enos Mills, who was the Denver Post dubbed Father of Rocky Mountain National Park, moved to the Rocky Mountains in 1884 at the age of 14. Mills was a naturalist that hired and trained nature guides. He was well known for his speeches in which he described the lives of the trees and animals of the Rocky Mountains. Mills saw value in protecting the Colorado Rockies and lobbied for the creation of a national park. He initially sought a much larger park, but logging and mining interests fought to reduce the park's eventual size to 415 square miles. Rocky Mountain National Park was the 10th national park established by the federal government. Today there are 59 national parks located throughout the United States. Now for an entry from the Peaked Interest blog entitled Axe-Wielding Maniacs by Matt Dahl. Ouray, Colorado is one of those great little mountain towns that's a little bit now and a little bit 1890s, surrounded by a staggering wall of mountains that creates a sense of separation from civilization. The town is a small oasis in an ever-urbanizing world. I've always been drawn to this town for its setting, historic charm, and its interesting residents. I have on occasion sat in my suburban cookie-cutter house and thought about the life I should be living in Ouray, though I realize these thoughts are something like fetishizing over a supermodel. My fiction may be way better than the reality. Over the years, I have read about the Ouray Ice Festival, a mid-January event held in a box canyon at the north end of the Uncompahgre Gorge, just outside of the town of Ouray. In the 1990s, Bill Witt and Gary Wilde began using hoses and piping to farm ice by cascading water down the sheer canyon walls to create an ice-climbing wonderland for a burgeoning ice-climbing movement. The Ice Festival draws thousands of people each year to participate in the ice climbing events, climb for fun, or just watch the axe-wielding maniacs take their lives into their own hands. I am definitely in the latter category. I find the idea of adventure sports fascinating. When Ouray was founded in the late 19th century, people risked their lives to trek across the mountains, ford whitewater rapids, and pad across ice-covered lakes and streams just to gather the food or get the things they needed to survive. I'm sure that our pioneering relatives and predecessors imagined a day when people could get unspoiled food from one central location, stay inside to take a leak, or have a bridge across a river. And yet, in a day and age when we could tell a woman, or an English-accented man, in our phone to order a pizza that someone will deliver in an electric car, more and more people are taking up sports that actually lower their predicted lifespan. And yet, as I write this, the hypocrisy of my wonderment is that my high-stress, sit-behind-a-computer, eat-late-at-night job is doing the same thing. So I say to you, squirrel-suit-flying, water-filled, cave-diving, rock-arch-swinging, ice-wall-climbing, crazy people, who are you? What are you chasing or running from? How do you live in the monotony of modernity when you regularly face your own mortality? And most importantly, will you take me with you?
my rock climbing Zen magazine classified ad would read, "Pasty white, nearsighted, middle-aged man with an aggrandized sense of his own wit seeks thrill-seeking wild person with delusions of invincibility to teach them just how to let go." Though to be clear, not to let go of anything that would cause me to fall to my death. The Ouray Ice Festival is a magnet for the world's thrill-seekers, and in my case, contact thrill-seekers. On my first day at the festival, the climbing event seemed like a practice in masochism. Contestants had 12 minutes to climb a slab of ice, then a rock precipice, and finally, because nature isn't challenging enough, a man-made box covered with an assortment of seemingly random things someone found in the bottom of a closet. Because I'm terrible with judging distance, I will say that the total climb was somewhere between 30 feet and 1,000 feet, though it was probably closer to 30. I went through the same progression of excitement for each contestant. The person would start their climb, and the first few minutes would be relatively boring, and I would wonder, was it a dumb idea to travel 7 hours to watch this? Then the climber would hit the rock portion of the climb, and the human drama would begin. As the climber sprang, dangled, and lurched from point to point, I started to lean in and wonder what their next move would be. Then as exhaustion began to grind on the contestant, they started to slow and stretch their limbs that were pushed over the red line of exertion, I would say their name. Quietly at first, but louder as their time ticked away. At this point, it didn't matter who they were or where they were from. This was a solitary human drama playing out in front of a crowd of people in overpriced outdoor gear. And in that moment, Emily, Chris, Alejandro, or whoever was climbing was my hero for doing what I knew I couldn't. Inevitably, they all fell, or at least the ones I watched. Gravity pulled and flesh failed, and my hero, my maniac with an axe, separated from the canyon wall, and we all made a collective gasp as nature once again came out on top. And then the rope caught, and our proxy of human strength and endurance descended to the ground. Their name, like so many great men and women in history, quickly faded from my mind as the next thrill-seeker began their ascent. And I again wondered why I drove all this way to see this. And so the cycle of drama went for several hours. For me, the highlight of the festival was not the competition. Rather, it was the people climbing for the joy, or the challenge, or the thrill, or who the hell knows why. The competition took place lower in the canyon. As one moved deeper into the Uncompahgre Gorge, away from Ouray and the competition, the canyon became deeper, and the ice became thicker. The scale of the climbing became inconceivable to my numbed city brain. Below me, in the ice-covered gateway to a frozen-over hell, the men and women that took on the massive sheets of ice were only noticeable because of their bright blue, orange, yellow, and green gear. I came closest to understanding why they do it when the sun broke through the overcast sky and threaded the needle of the crevasse opening to illuminate the ice. I have heard that the Eskimos have 1,000 words for snow, describing it in all of its conditions. What I saw in the canyon also required 1,000 words to describe. With the extra light, I could see brown ice, white ice, brilliant blue ice. It was rock hard, brittle, and slushy. The surface was flat, rippled, mounded, and jagged. It broke into powder, bits, chunks, and Volkswagens. It was beautiful, it was harsh, and it was an amazing thing to behold. When the sun fell behind the peaks, the wind picked up, and the temperature dropped, my family made it clear that it was time to go. As we walked back to Ouray, I had my own moment of delusion when I said to my brother that I thought I could go ice climbing. My brother, as is his right as my brother, promptly reminded me that I was too chicken to jump the 20 feet from a bridge near our childhood home into liquid water, so he had some doubts about me being able to climb 60 feet high on frozen water. He's probably right. And while in my heart I feel like I could do it, the truth is that for the foreseeable future, the only ice I will be testing my will against will be the icicle I knock off the eave of my house or the cubes in my gin. For those of you that are interested in the Ouray Ice Festival, Ouray is located on U.S. Highway 550, 70 miles north of Durango and 98 miles south of Grand Junction. The website for the Ouray Ice Park is www.urayicepark.com. And by the way, if you do go to Ouray, I highly recommend that you get Mouse's Famous Scrap Cookie at Mouse's Chocolates and Coffee at 520 Main Street. Weekly Peaker is a production of Peaked Interest Media. Peaked Interest is a media company focused on telling the stories of the people, places, and mythology of the Mountain West. More at peakedinterestmedia.com. Thank you for listening to this week's Weekly Peaker. find your story, and have a great week.